Welcome. Thank you for joining us for the third in this series of Inside Out Conversations, where we look at the inner life on the basis of the idea that all of us have the same authority and influence within our own spheres as the most powerful people in the world have within theirs. They just maybe influence more people than we do. But each of us has a unique vocation, a unique opportunity to make a life, to co-create something beautiful with the spirit of love. We've been having conversations with some of our favorite people, Bill McKibben, Broderick Greer, and tonight Nadia Bolz-Weber, about the inner life. And the invitation is to consider for yourselves where you are at in your lives and how you might resonate or not resonate, and the decisions each of us might make going forward about how to step into more love and more well-being and more hope. I'm going to begin with a blessing, and then we'll have a piece of music to play just to help us reflect and get into the space. This is a blessing from our friend John O'Donohue. It's called Banach, which is the Irish word for blessing. On the day when the weight deadens on your shoulders and you stumble, may the clay dance to balance you. And when your eyes freeze behind the gray window and the ghost of loss gets into you, may a flock of colors, gold, red, green, indigo, and azure blue, come to awaken in you a meadow of delight. When the canvas frays in the curragh of thought and a stain of ocean blackens beneath you, may there come across the waters a path of yellow moonlight to guide you safely home. May the nourishment of the earth be yours. May the fluency of the ocean be yours. May the protection of the ancestors be yours. And so may a slow wind work these words of love around you, an invisible cloak to mind your life. You deserve to be known by the miracle of a day. You are cradled through the night, the dusk affirming yesterday's work. You don't just wake, you awaken unto something. The miracle of a day. What can happen in a day? Everything. Stand in front of the mirror and repeat 20 times, I'm super cool and beautiful and thrillingly alive. Let's just do that once. I'll remind you of it again. I'm super cool and beautiful and thrillingly alive.
I'm super cool and beautiful and thrillingly alive.
In the shower, be gentle with your skin as if you were caressing a Rodin sculpture of a nude human. Pick up the first piece of rubbish you see and turn it into an origami Yoda. Make breakfast as if you were making love and eat it that way too. Make sure no one's watching. This time is for you to ready yourself for the miracle of a day. Your day. Go out into the world of wonder. Trees and roads and cars and buildings and books and restaurants and computers and desks and the greatest wonder, people. Oh, people. Screwed up and gorgeous, alive and dying, deceitful and trying hard to be good. They need you. We need you. Show us your love and your origami Yoda. Hold yourself like you believe in your own glory, not more than or less than others, but inviting them into the same. Take delight in your foibles. Laugh when you lose your keys again. Smile a wry smile at the first 15 sexual fantasies that interrupt your conference call. Stretch your arms and legs and neck and let your voice transcend Walt Whitman. For goodness sake, make it a beatific yawp. Take yourself out to lunch and enjoy the sacrament of interruption that is queuing and choosing and eating. Look up at the sky. Look up at the sky. Look up at the sky. This is your roof. Know that you're not the only one thinking this, and that both of you are right. Then, when the working day is winding down, readying itself to give way to rest and play, find someone who needs your smile. Give it to them, and you'll never lose it. May you find the anamkara within, soul friendship with yourself that opens unto others, makes a home for them, and transfigures your inner life. May you be the friend to yourself that we are all waiting for.
Who wrote that? Whose piece is that?
Who wrote that?
Is that you?
Someone who lives in my head.
Did you write that? That was so
thank you. The reason I read that is, you know, one of the great, he would never call himself a spiritual master. In fact, he would reject the notion. He'd say, like, the more spiritual master you are, the less you get it. But my mentor and someone who means a lot to a lot of people in this room, John O'Donohue, told me once, and he wrote about this too, that he made himself a promise once that he would always be his, or at least he would always strive to be his own best friend. That way you can never break up. And I think that the question of vocation, which is what we're here to discuss, is often talked about as something highfalutin, elevated only for people who have public lives. And it's also dead serious and definitely not fun. And I want to suggest that vocation is where the needs of the world and your friendship with yourself meet, which is a paraphrase of someone else's comment regarding the needs of the world and your heart and your skill, which is true as well. But I think all of us might have experienced when work is truest, it doesn't feel like work. It feels like friendship with the world. And it's lovely to have here, as her last public engagement at Greenbelt this year, and the last of these three little conversations, someone who I don't just know from afar, but who is a friend. We're here to talk about vocation, but that really means we're here to talk about friendship with your own soul. So let us start with something that's counterintuitive in the religious world. Because we're supposed to be really humble and ego-free and not rate our own skills. Let's just drive a bus through that false humility and ask you, when you're looking in the mirror and saying, I'm beautiful and super cool and thrillingly alive, what do you know you're best at?
Preaching.
Mm-hmm. What's preaching?
I mean, really, my primary vocational identity is not that I'm a writer or a speaker or even a pastor. My primary vocational identity is that I'm a preacher. So that's how I think of myself, and it's how I orient almost everything I do, every talk I do. When I'm doing pastoral care in my parish, I do it so that I can be their preacher. So I don't know how to sort of express, how to proclaim good news to people if I don't know what kind of good news they need, what that package needs to look like. And so I don't know how to preach to them if I don't know their stories. So I don't do pastoral care to be therapeutic necessarily, because I'm not that good at it. Like, I'm not like that quivering mass of emotional availability some pastors are. So I'm not into the, like...
Really?
I know, it's hard to really... I really give off this super nurturing, come to me, I'll take care of you vibe.
I'm about as far on the edge of the stage as I can get without falling off. I'm going to, you know... I love you. There we go.
But I do pastoral care, so I know how to be people's preacher. I mean, preaching to me is about... I just feel like people are weighed down and they're in bondage and they need some freedom. And to me, preaching is about freedom. You know, it's about letting go of your projects and your machinations towards saving yourself or making yourself worthy, any kind of salvation project, anything that weighs you down, and lay it down and hear that, like, everything you're trying to do for yourself has already been done for you. So, I don't know.
I know, you know, you preached before you were a professional priest. Do you remember when the first time you did something that you could define as preaching?
Yeah, for sure. The very first thing was, I'm, you know, a recovering addict and alcoholic, and I had been a comic during a period of my life, and another comic who was a recovering alcoholic who I was close to lost his battle with mental illness, and his name's PJ, and he hung himself. And at the time, I hadn't been to seminary, and but I was Christian, and all of our friends just immediately sort of turned to me and said, well, you can do his funeral, right? And literally just because I was the only religious one in my friend group. And I said, yeah, I could do that. And so PJ's funeral was in this comedy club in downtown Denver, and it was packed with comics and academics and queers and recovering alcoholics, and giving PJ's eulogy and speaking about PJ as a child of God in that environment. And it smelled like stale beer and bad jokes, you know? I mean, like, you could smell the bad jokes from the comedy club. And I looked out and I saw the people and I thought, they don't have a pastor. Like, these people don't have a pastor. And then I thought, oh, shit. I think that's me. So it was, everything in my life has been just set in front of me in a way. I don't have this sort of ambition. What I've been able to do is not due to like an ambition, and I had this goal out here and then I took steps. Like, I've just responded to things put in front of me over and over and over again, whether it's writing or speaking or pastoring or any of that is just stuff that has been placed in front of me, and I try to pay attention and respond to it.
So I'm wondering if you maybe even preached earlier than that. Were you a preacher as a child? What was your childhood like?
I was precocious as a child just because of the situation of being a sick kid, you know, and having a particular lens on society. There's a particular lens on society that comes from alienation. And so I had that lens really early. And so...
Why were you alienated?
I spoke about it earlier, but I was alienated because I had a autoimmune disorder that caused me to look abnormal. My face was abnormal and couldn't be fixed till I was 16. And so I really couldn't go in public without people being like, oh my God, did you see that? I mean, it was very shocking the way I looked. With my eyes couldn't close. So my eyeballs bulged out of my head so far that my eyes couldn't close. So
alienation granted you
It grants you a lens into on society, and specifically, it gives you you can understand bullshit very quickly. And so, I became sort of cynical and critical of culture very young. I could say that. Mm-hmm. So, and I was sort of I was sarcastic and funny and sort of caustic at like 12, mm-hmm. you know. So in that way, I think I told the truth about stuff mm-hmm. in ways that was, I think, uncomfortable for people to hear out of a kid. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, a lot of mainstream psychology might say that people overcompensate for the wounds they experience as children,
yes.
and then they do something in reaction to that.
Yes.
I'm not so sure that's true. I wonder if at times the things that look like wounds were actually the acorn of the gift.
Oh, no question. All the pain from that, every ounce of pain I've experienced in my life, I would not wish away.
Mm-hmm.
None of it. None of it. Because it's all been useful. Every single piece of mm-hmm. it. Every single thing that has happened to me, good and bad, has in some way been useful to other people.
Mm-hmm.
And to myself.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would never wish, as hard as all of it was, being an addict, all that stuff, as hard as every piece of that was, I wouldn't change any of it. Nothing mm-hmm. in my life. I'm not given to morbid reflection.
Mm-hmm.
And I because I see the way God redeems our crap, you know, so why would I say, let's not have crap when it ends up being redeemed in ways in our lives and for the benefit of other people. So, yeah, it's all useful. God uses the whole buffalo.
One of my oldest friends said to me once, you know, you have such an interesting life. I wish I had an interesting life like you. And my reflex response was to say, well, if it's what it takes to have a stable relationship and be financially secure, I wish I had a boring life like you.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And you can have both. You can have contentment and also have that dissident perspective.
Yeah, no, I'm super glad that the crazy is mostly in my past.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so, I mean, there's very little drama in my life. The drama in my life comes from my parishioners, so I don't cultivate it, nor do I welcome it in any way in my private life. So my relationships now that I cultivate are with people who are solid and stable. So because I have enough drama and chaos in the life of my parishioners, I don't create it in my own. Yeah.
So you say that most of the crazy is in your past. What are the spiritual practices that have come to you, that have invited you, that have been helpful?
Well, I'm not, I just cannot do the like contemplative thing in the morning, the like quiet time with the Lord or whatever people call it. I can't, like, that is not me at all. Like it doesn't work for me. And so, I see really particular things as still being spiritual practices. Like, I think taking care of my physical body is a spiritual practice. I only eat food made out of food, which is very strange for an American. And
they might not let you back in now that you've said that.
And I've always been very physically active, so taking care of my physical body is how I take care of my inner self as well. And for years, I did a thing called CrossFit, which is this very intense training regimen. And I was very competitive, and I was ranked internationally, and I could lift 150 pounds over my head, which is not entirely necessary to do. But I just like to know I could lift a grown man over my head if I need to. But anyway, so it was really intense. But 7 months ago, out of nowhere, I stopped doing it. And I started doing yoga. And if you told me a year ago I'd not be doing CrossFit and I'd be doing yoga, I'd tell you you were insane. But it's become like my contemplative practice is to practice yoga in a really sort of rigorous way every day. And
what does it do for you?
The part that's hardest for me is there are literally postures in yoga called heart openers, and I'm like, no thanks. Like, I want to protect my heart, and yet this practice makes me open it, and yet that's what I really need. I don't need to protect myself anymore. I mean, I think my instinct my whole life has been to protect myself, and I actually need to do that less and less in some ways. And so I felt my heart being more open in just this physical practice of yoga that I've been doing. So.
I mean, and thank you for opening your heart to tell us about it. Now, can I just ask you, like, what happens when you open your heart?
Well, it's terrifying. I mean, I spent a long time, you know, I'm on the road so much, and I would just protect myself when I was traveling to speak. It's hard. I'm not an extrovert, and so it's hard for me to interact one-on-one with a lot of people, and I'm around a lot of people, so I would just shut myself down as much as possible, and then I was losing these opportunities that were in front of me. I don't know how to explain that any better, but I just don't feel like I have to protect myself as much as I used to, and I don't know why that is, but it feels like my spirit's been exfoliated in some way, and I don't know why. I don't know why anything happens. I just try to pay attention to the fact that it is happening.
And there's something here about how the way spiritual practices are talked about sometimes that suggests if you're not able to do the quiet time in the
right.
morning, that there's something wrong with you.
Yeah.
And by the same token, if you feel really drawn to that more traditional contemplative practice,
right.
that you're either better or there's something wrong with you too because you're weird in that
right.
you can do it.
Well, I think there's just something wrong with you.
Well, thank you.
Just
wow.
Like
that's
everyone,
what happens when you open your
everyone,
heart.
Yeah. Just everyone. I think you shouldn't be afraid of like, oh, it
yeah.
seems like there's definitely something wrong with you. So just embrace it. And but yeah, I think that there's this, and really it comes down to like almost a certain personality. I mean, I was raised in a Christian tradition where it's like that you were really supposed to have a certain personality. If you were a good Christian, you know, like you're super duper positive thinking and you're, you know, really clean cut and you talk a certain way and you look a certain way and you live a certain way and you watch,
good at making casseroles and lying about everything real.
It's just like, and I was like, I totally don't have that personality. What am I going to do? You know? And it's fine if you're actually wired to be like that. There's nothing wrong with being that particular type of person. But then when we say that's what spiritual looks like, we have the same problem with the New Age culture, which I was trying to address a little bit this morning. It's the same thing in the stupid yoga culture I go to. It's like, you know, having painfully good posture and the passive-aggressive half whisper and the, you know, it's like, I just, like, if I have a yoga teacher who I think is even vaguely pretentious, I'm like, I'm out of here. I can't do it. But my yoga teacher, who I like the most, came into class a couple weeks ago. He's been teaching yoga forever, and I love this guy. And he was in his little Dharma talk at the beginning of the class. He actually said he got so angry at his teenager right before class, he threw his yoga mat across the room. I was like, dude, you are the perfect yoga teacher. Like, let's do it. Like, I'm all in because I trust you, you know? So I think in spirituality, whether it's Christianity or yoga or whatever, there's this temptation towards pretension. And I don't have a taste for that. Like, I would just rather have you be totally honest about why something's hard for you, and then I'll trust you. Like, then I'll listen to what you have to teach me. If I suspect you're pretending to know it all or pretending to have it together, I can't listen to anything you say.
What have been some of the challenges? Woo! Applause is welcome. You were
only one at a time.
So we got a long night. Good, good. Thank you. You get your prize. So this is the part where I remind you that you were going to ask me about my spiritual
that's right.
practices.
Yeah, we had this conversation. Interviewing a narcissist 101. No, I actually was really interested in that because we had this cool conversation before this about your own practices, which I think is helpful.
Funny okay, you should
well,
mention
well,
that.
Let me just say. I was telling him that Richard Rohr, who I love, and he's a friend of both of ours, he can be a bit much with his whole, like...
And thank you, Nadia, for being with us today. Just to raise that...
I love him so much, but... And he is my go-to source for wisdom, but he can be a bit much around the whole, like, if you're a real contemplative, it means 20 minutes of contemplation every morning. And I'm like, kill me. Kill me. And so I had this long walk with Richard like a month ago, and I told him about the yoga thing. And I don't know if you guys are into Enneagram. It's a personality thing. So, and like, we're on this walk, and I said, I feel like I finally have the contemplative practice that works for me, but it comes through rigorous physical activity before I can get into the space. And he literally stopped walking and looked at me, and he goes, oh my gosh, that totally makes sense, because you're an eight on the Enneagram. And like, eights are all about the body, and you feel everything in your gut, and there's this passion to being an eight. And so he just, it was like affirming. Like, Richard Rohr was like, that's okay that you do yoga as your spiritual practice. I was like, I win! So anyway.
If someone hacks your Twitter account and says, Richard Rohr can be a bit much... Kill me. Richard would love it. He would absolutely love it. Yeah. So I really appreciate the way we got to talk about my spiritual practices just there. And no, really, tell me about being a narcissist. Do you by any chance want to know anything about my spiritual practices? Anyone? Anyone?
Please tell me.
So I, you know, it's funny. I grew up in that kind of tradition that said, you know, you got to do a period of time before you do anything else in the day where you read the Bible and you pray in the traditional out loud way, preferably with a series of notes that have been produced by a company in England, right? You know, because we didn't know there were other people who did Bible reading notes. And I felt terrible shame throughout my teenage years and early 20s until I got over this, because I didn't realize this just comes down to the kind of person you are, to the way your psyche is built. There are many beautiful, profound spiritual practices that are life-giving to me that eights wouldn't find life-giving. I'm a four on the Enneagram. I'm married to an eight, and he's really into his yoga. And he's not so much into reading first. In fact, we recently had this learning. Oh, Brian, if you're listening to this, I know I haven't asked if it's okay to tell this story to hundreds of people, but hopefully it'll be useful. That, you know, he wakes up in the morning and he's like, I'm into the day, right? I'm into the day. And he'll, like, you know, what time are we meeting later on? And my brain can't do it. When I wake up in the morning, I need to kind of gently ease myself in and do a lot of self-affirmation, because my brain resets when I sleep. And I tend to wake up feeling heavy. And I need to do a little bit. I need to create some space to let that lift. And what I do is really simple. It's important to note, I work from home, so this is possible for me. So there's another shaming level around, you know, not tuning into the patterns of the way our hours in the day are required to be spent if we're working. And it's okay if you have a job or other commitments that require you to be doing something else in the early morning. It's okay to carve out time elsewhere. It's also okay to find spiritual practices that are life-giving for you and mine. Or one of them is, I'll get up, I'll make a cup of coffee. It's bulletproof coffee, which those who know about that understand it's a good thing. Those who don't think I've just said something awful and insane. Bulletproof coffee is coffee blended with grass-fed butter. It's not crazy. One of the things it does is it prevents you getting the kind of massive quick hit of caffeine. So it genuinely does work with my spiritual practice, because I don't want to go in buzzed like this. So I make the coffee, I go and sit in my little office, I put on the piece of music that I played at the start of this session, which for anyone who wants to know is Max Richter's recomposed version of the Four Seasons by Vivaldi. And then that kind of eases me into the chair, and I just start to breathe slowly. And the next piece on the playlist is Ray Vaughan Williams' The Lark Ascending, which is one of the greatest pieces of music ever composed, I think. And it's 15 minutes long. And I listen to that piece of music every single day, sometimes three times. Sometimes I just let it play three times. And I write a little bit in a journal, and then I try to hold myself to just one page in the journal, because otherwise I start to bore myself. And then I read something. Life-giving. It doesn't matter what it is. Fiction, non-fiction. There is no sacred secular divide, so it doesn't have to be written by a spiritual person, quote unquote. And then I'm ready for the day, and I get into work, and it happens to work with the rhythms of my life. Yoga for me is a nightmare. It's a nightmare. The last time I did hot yoga, I spent 4 days in bed and needed to see 2 chiropractors and 1 Chinese herbalist. I think the lesson the universe wanted to teach me was don't do fucking yoga. There should be permission. And that leads me to want to ask you, when people say to you, wow, your church is so creative. It looks like you wanted to say something else first, did you? No, okay. When people have said, wow, your church is amazingly creative. You were telling me back there, what do you say?
I said this last night in a session that we do crazy stuff that is just fun and just makes sense for us. And then people are like, wow, you must have a lot of creative people in your parish, which we actually don't. But I think what people are attracted to isn't creativity. I think it's freedom, and that we actually have the same amount of freedom as any other church. I just don't think most churches know how free they are. But I think most people don't know how free they are. I mean, I'm in this thing for the freedom, I feel like at every turn we want to turn it into a worthiness project or, the High Commission on Worthiness, whether it's, social justice worthiness or, Christian living worthiness. And we want to take Christianity and turn it into the High Commission on Worthiness at every turn when really Jesus came to give us life and life abundant. This is about the freedom, And I don't know. I feel like a free person. Like I really don't feel in bondage to much anymore.
Can you pinpoint a moment or two in your life where that, where you kind of took a step forward into that freedom?
Well, certainly going through the 12 steps. I mean, being a recovering alcoholic and addict, that gives you freedom from the bondage of self to a certain degree, because you have to really excavate your insides in order to tell the truth about how you got into the situation you got into. And that gives you, I don't understand why it feels like in the church we're so afraid to speak the truth. To be really, really honest, when Jesus said it's the thing that would set us free. I mean, truth is the thing that sets us free. And so the more honest we are, the more truthful we are, the more free we are. Because if we're not, what we're in bondage to is having to keep pretending something is true, And that's a project I just am not interested in undertaking anymore.
So a lot of people don't think we're addicted to anything because the addiction isn't obvious or external. It doesn't manifest through alcohol or other substances. And that seems to me to be unfortunate, because most people are then forfeiting the possibility of receiving the benefit of a 12-step community.
Yeah.
How have you encouraged people who don't feel they're addicted to benefit from the kinds of things that 12-step movement offers?
Well, actually, I suggest everyone read the first 164 pages of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. After that, it's just stories, and the stories change with each edition. Those are fine, but the actual Big Book's only 164 pages. And there is so much profound spiritual truth in that book. I'll tell you my least favorite thing in the Big Book. This is my least favorite thing. I think it's the worst thing they wrote. It says, talks about resentment, like if we resent someone, it calls resentment the dubious luxury of ordinary men. But alcoholics can't afford to be resentful because we drink over it. And so you have to get rid of resentment. And so what happens in this is it says if somebody's done you harm in your adult life, not as a child, but if someone's hurt you, and you resent them, maybe they were very wrong in what they did, fine. But it says this, if you look back far enough, you will find that at some point in the past, you made a decision based on self that put you in a position to be harmed. Oh my God. Is that the worst thing you've ever heard in your life? Like, isn't that the last thing you want to be true? That's the last thing I want to be true. I want that guy to be an asshole, and that's the real point, right? So this person hurt me. Like, they did something they shouldn't have done, whatever. And I want the whole point of my hurt to be the fact that that guy's a jerk and was wrong, right? But you know what? There is no freedom for me in that project. None. I think I'll be free if I can detail to as fine a point as possible why the other person was wrong. And they could very well be wrong, that's fine. That's actually none of my business. Like, my business is, what part did I play in it? Because what happens is I know on some deep level what part I played in it. Maybe it's only 5% of the whole situation, but if I know that it's there, I will try even harder to pretend it's not there and to blame that person fully, because I can't stand the hurt of the fact that I participated in someone else hurting me. Do you see what I'm saying? This is personal work. This is doing personal work, is saying what is yours and what is not yours. And that project of doing personal work is what gives you freedom. And I say this in pastoral care. People will come to me and they'll have some kind of crisis or drama going on, and I'll listen as compassionately as I can for up to 10 minutes. I will. I'll have a totally open heart. I'll let them go on their rant about why this is happening.
You did this
and
to me once.
Did
I remember. We did this, and it was so deeply moving to you, you don't remember it. I can... In a cafe early morning, Denver, about 4 years ago, you actually said to me, okay, the question is, what are you going to do with this?
Right, totally.
So, I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, it's like they'll go on and on about some horrible thing in their life and why they're a victim and why this thing happened and who this person, and I'm in this situation, and they're on this, it's this, you know, thing that goes over and over and over and over and over again. So I let them get it out, and I sit there in a space of compassion, and then I go, okay, what part did you play in that? What's your part of that? Because there is no freedom for you in going through the cycle over and over and over again. We think there is, and there's not. The only freedom we have is in being able to honestly say, what was my part, even if it was this much? Then you're free, right? And the same thing, actually, from my religious upbringing. You know, it was painful being raised a fundamentalist Christian, and there were things that were very difficult about that and things I resented for a very long time. They gave me these black and white categories, this dualistic thinking to look at everything in the world. You're either good or bad, you're saved, you're not, you're Christian, you're whatever. So it was like dualistic thinking is what they gave me. And somebody who was raised in that same tradition came to my church and was so still angry about it, so still resentful and reactive about all that crap from their religious upbringing. And they noticed that I wasn't. They just noticed I was sort of free from it. I don't have that anymore. And they said, when did that happen for you? When did you feel like you were free from all that resentment and anger from your upbringing? And I realized when I was able to look at my religious upbringing and not think dualistically about it, not use the way of thinking I inherited from them, when I could see there were good things, even though that's not to discount the bad, but when I was able to confess that I was actually still loved in that place or see the good in it, when I was able to sort of transcend that dualistic thinking, when thinking about the religious environment that gave me the dualistic thinking, then I was free. Then I was free from it.
And it's important to say that the owning your part does not mean you're on your own in it.
No, right.
Learning to ask for help.
Yeah,
even because
right.
It seems to me we know now that at a neurological level, it isn't just the repetition of the story that's boring. It's digging a groove into neural pathways,
right.
And
people
keeping us stuck in it. Mm-hmm. So just shifting one part,
yes.
And one part might be to say, "Hey, I don't know what to do with this. Can you help me?"
Yeah,
and the response might be simply like, get a better night's sleep tonight.
Right.
You know,
right.
One moment at a time. It's definitely about asking.
Yeah.
that asking is a courageous act.
And also, I think one of the reasons, and I've written this about forgiveness as well, is that one reason I think we don't want to forgive people who've hurt us is we feel like it comes perilously close to saying that, oh, it was okay what they did, right? And it's not, it's saying, actually, what you did was so not okay, I refuse to be tied to it anymore. Mm-hmm. Because as long as I resent you, I'm tied to it. Mm. It's a chain. I'm in bondage to that thing that you did and who you are and all of your stuff. And what that is so bad that I refuse to be connected to it anymore. So I'm going to be free by saying I'm going to cut that chain. So,
couple more questions before we pause and move into an exercise, and then we'll wrap up with a few more minutes with you, Nadia. What's a movie or a book or a piece of music that nurtures you?
Well, I gotta be a fangirl at Greenbelt. I tried to not embarrass myself too much, but Francis Spufford was here, and he wrote a book called Unapologetic. And that book, Francis Spufford says all the things I try to say, but better by half. And so I feel like being able to read that book was just like pure light and life to me, because it helped me further articulate what I believe to be true, and I needed that. Like it and it's funny because the sermon I preached the Sunday during the week I read that book, right, was so derivative. I mean, it was just so clearly like if somebody could go, she must have been reading Francis Spufford this week, you know. So I'll just throw that out there that's a brilliant piece of work that has that I'll return to over and over again.
Almost certainly available about 120 feet that way.
I hope so.
My last question for now is what would it mean to you to be your own best friend?
I don't think I'm far from it, to tell you the truth. I really don't, I don't have, shame is not something I have a lot of. Actually, my dad was talking about, he said, honey, you really have something special with your speaking and your writing and being honest about yourself. I said, no, Daddy, I think technically I have something missing. I think it's called shame. Like, it doesn't bother me to say these things about myself. So I do not allow people to treat me disrespectfully. I take care of myself. I have a million ways in which I take care of myself so I can do the work I'm called to do.
And to anyone who might be thinking, yeah, that's all right for you, but there's no way I could do that.
Well, what, I haven't always been like this.
Pardon me?
I haven't always been I mean, you know, there have been times in my life where I've chosen to have damaging relationships around me, that I've not taken care of my physical body, that I haven't slept the way I should, that I didn't respect myself. I mean, there's ways in which I've lived that, and for whatever reason, and I think it comes down to vocation, honest to God. I think it has to do with vocation. Whatever effect my work has, my preaching, my pastoring, my speaking, my writing, whatever effect that has on people in the world, I don't feel responsible for that. But I feel responsible to that. And so what am I going to do to honorably be responsible to whatever is happening in my work? So I have to be able to show up for it. I have to be well rested. I have to have, I don't travel by myself. That's just one thing, right? Like, I told my publisher I will not do a book tour alone. It's not mentally healthy for me to not have people around me, to not have someone who truly knows me with me. And so I almost always travel with somebody who knows me, and that's a way of friending myself, by saying, like, this is something I need, and I need it to be able to do the work, and I think the work is important. So it's really tied to vocation for me, I think. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah. All right.
Oh, just one. One person.
Now we know the answer to the age-old question, what is the sound of multiple variations on one hand clapping. So, most of you, if not all of you, should have a little card like this. If you don't have a card like this that was distributed at the start, can you put your hand out? And if I can ask, Sam, could you help? The cards are in that box. Would you mind distributing them around? Thank you. This is an amazing double-sided postcard. On one side, there's blue and a piece of information, which we'll tell you a little bit about in a minute. Keep your hand up if you don't have one. On the other side, it is blank, and this is for you to write stuff down. There's an invitation here to reflect on this question of what it means to be your own best friend. And what I want to invite you to consider is Greenbelt is an annual thing. And whether or not you'll be here next year, the August bank holiday is an annual thing too. And I'd like to see if we can, as a community of people, take one more step into becoming our own best friend. So in a moment or two, we're going to play the music, if that's all right, that we played at the start. And during that time, I want you to be silent and to think about what is one thing you could do in the next year that you would do if you were your own best friend. Now, it can be one specific thing, like go away for the weekend somewhere, or it can be a more general repeated thing, like wash the dishes as soon as the meal is over so that you feel more relaxed later. So it could be a daily thing or a one-off thing. It could be a big thing or a small thing. What I ask, however, is that it be a measurable thing. So not, I'm going to love myself more. It needs to be something measurable. And the reason for that is you want to be able to look back in a year's time and ask, did I actually do this? It's not about punishment. It's about this question of freedom that, when done well, looks like amazing creativity. So we'll play the music, and when the music is done, I want you to turn to the person next to you, whether you know them or not, and trust that they are stepping into this exercise too, and tell them the thing that you've thought that you'd like to do in the next year. And if you haven't been able to think of something yet, have a conversation with them, and maybe they can help you. Ask about those of you who are here the first night. Ask about those things that give you life rather than the things that bring death to you. And then write down two things. Write down the measurable activity and write down the email address or the phone number of the person sitting next to you so that in a week's time, you can send them a text or an email and say, I'm doing it. Or, can you remind me what it was again? And not only if you practice this will you have made yourself more of your own best friend, you might make a new actual human friend too. So we'll play the music, and all you have to do during the music is to think, what is one measurable thing that I could do in the next year that I would do if I were my own best friend? And then you don't need to remember all the instructions. That's all you need to do for now. And when the music's over, I'll tell you what to do next. Thank you, everybody. Lovely. So I invite you to talk to someone next to you and let them know what you wrote down, and maybe invite their feedback to help you make it more measurable or to get something measurable in the first place, and to exchange contact details, whichever degree you feel comfortable around that, Facebook, phone number, email, whatever. And you're welcome to not share your contact details if you don't wish to. If you do, I invite you to make a commitment to each other that a week from today, you'll just check in about this. You don't have to do it more than once. just the once, a week from today. Because sometimes when we go to things like Greenbelt, amazing stuff surfaces, and then we leave. this is a practice for real life. This is a practice for next week and for a bleak Thursday in November. And we'll check back in with you in 3 or 4 minutes. So, what a gift. What a gift to be here in this beautiful place with this exquisite weather this evening and with so much animated conversation and intent. What I see is intent, and I want to thank you for both paying attention and having intentions to love yourselves more. I think the world needs more people loving themselves, not for ego reasons, but because people who love themselves just exude that for others too. I want to tell you what The Porch is. The Porch is a new magazine. It's going to have its first issue in October this year. It's an attempt at slowing down the way we think about the world and stepping into more beautiful and healing ways of talking about things, even the difficult things. You can find out more about it if you sign up to get our email newsletter, which will not bombard you. Just go to theporchmagazine.com, put your email address in. We'll send you one or two emails between now and October to tell you how we can get it. A couple of things I'm really excited about are that the voices of women, people of color and indigenous people and LGBT people will be disproportionately featured in this magazine. And you can subscribe for whatever you can afford. There will be a subscription price, but you don't have to meet that price. It'll be £4 an issue, but if you need to pay less, that's totally welcome. If you can pay a little more to help us do, among other things, actually pay our writers, and if you're a writer, you'll be delighted to hear that, because that's rare these days. Would love you to be on board. We're trying to build a community, and I have the privilege of being the editor of The Porch Magazine. My last... Oh, I have to tell you the top three films of the year. Some people want that, right? Oh, yeah. So I've been doing this thing where I've been running down my vision of really the top 12 or so films of the last year. And let me give them to you if I can get my notes to work. So to recap, at number 12, The Little Prince. At number 11, the HBO miniseries Show Me a Hero. At number 10, Where to Invade Next. I'm going to put these on my blog, so you don't need to frantically write them. Go to GarethHiggins.net. But sign up for The Porch newsletter before you go to GarethHiggins.net. Number 9, Hunt for the Wilder People, which is about to open in the UK. It's just a delicious New Zealand comedy about real life. Beyoncé's Lemonade, at number 8, is a masterpiece. Number 7, Terrence Malick's film Knight of Cups, which is kind of the Pilgrim's Progress for today in the inner life of an extraordinarily good-looking writer, so I identified with it. Captain Fantastic, with Viggo Mortensen raising his family in the woods. That's up to number 6. Here are the ones I haven't mentioned before. Number 5, Last Days in the Desert, a new film in which Ewan McGregor plays Jesus, and I think it's the best Jesus film since The Last Temptation of Christ. Hasn't been released or assigned a release date in the UK, so I imagine it will be on video on demand soon. It's called Last Days in the Desert. It's made by Rodrigo Garcia, who is the son of Gabriel Garcia Marquez. If you're interested in literature or in cinema at all, I really hope you'll see it. Number 4 is an Icelandic film called Rams, which is about two brothers who are sheep farmers who live right next door to each other and haven't spoken for 40 years. And something happens that requires them to deal with each other. A better film about reconciliation you'd be hard-pressed to find. And a more honest film about how miracles don't often look dramatic, and catharsis often doesn't happen in the moment, but over a long extended period of time. This film embodies that. I find it hard to speak afterwards, which is saying something. Number three is The Assassin, an extraordinary, visually astounding experience in which an assassin proves the greater efficacy of nonviolence and refusing to submit to the kind of power that wants to exercise itself through hurting others. Number two, I've already mentioned because it was screening here last night and I wanted to let you all know about it, is Embrace of the Serpent, the first Colombian film to be nominated for the Best Foreign Film Oscar, a film about a shaman taking two Westerners up the Amazon 40 years apart in the early part of the last century. And number one is a three-minute-long short film, the likes of which I've never seen before. I've never put a short film at my number one. I saw it last week prior to Jason Bourne, and I walked out of Jason Bourne early because, first of all, Jason Bourne was terrible, and secondly, I didn't need to see anything after I saw Channel 4's promotional video for the Paralympics called yes. We're the Superhumans.
Yes. Yes.
I think this is not just a work of astonishing creative and technical yeah. craft. I think it's a piece of prophecy.
Yeah.
Naming that which is, it is the kingdom of God. It is about how everyone has a place at the table, and it is about how privilege needs to give way, not just because privilege oppresses marginalized people, but because privilege oppresses privileged people.
It oppresses beauty.
Yeah, absolutely, it oppresses beauty, and those of us living blind to our privilege are being damaged by it. I was elevated, I laughed, I cried. I was talking with some folk at Greenbelt about it, and because I haven't had a great, I haven't been able to get good cell service, I'm told that there is a version of the video which is sign interpreted as well, so look for that if you haven't seen that either. And tell people about this video. I no longer live in the British Isles. I live in the United States. I saw this video and I wanted to say to my British and Irish friends, there's something culturally very special when one of the national broadcasters makes something like this. Please keep sending stuff like this to Nadia's home and my adopted home. We're the Superhumans. I think it's the best film of the year. The last question of this session and of this series of three conversations called Inside Out. The last question, Nadia, looking out at this group of people, if you were never going to see them again, what's the blessing you would give?
I think I was taught that being in right relationship with God meant making sure I was so good that I never had to bother him. But I think being in right relationship with God means understanding that God is a forgiving, redemptive God that we need to be in relationship with because we need forgiveness and redemption, and there's nothing wrong with that. There's nothing wrong with needing forgiveness and redemption, because when you can lay bare why you need it, you get to be in right relationship with God, because God gets to act upon you in the way that God seeks and desires to act upon you, which is to forgive and redeem. There's no shame in any of that. Like, I always wonder how the Garden of Eden story would have been different if, when God said, "Where are you?" and they said, "Well, we were ashamed of our nakedness and we hid." And God said, "Who told you you were naked?" I wonder if instead of them hiding and they were filled with shame and they hid and they blamed and they were fearful of God. This is what shame does. So how the story would have been different if they just went, "Oh yeah, we fucked up." Like, because there's no shame. Shame doesn't come. There's no place for shame. No place for shame at all. Like, what if shame hadn't come in? What if when they made those when they did those things, they just said, we listen to a voice other than you, tell us who we are. And we did these things, and God could then be the God God wants to be for us and forgive and redeem and restore and make new. How that story would have been different, you know? So that is to say, fuck shame. I mean, if there is something that's broken in you, if there's something that you feel like hasn't gone well, or some brokenness, some pain, there's no reason for shame. It's only an occasion for God to do God's thing in you. Why be ashamed of that? So don't be afraid of the truth, because it is the thing that will set you free.
I want to thank you for showing your appreciation to our friend, our guest, our teacher, Nadia Boltz-Weber. It's been a gift to share these three sessions with you. We began with the words of John O'Donohue. We'll end with them. A simple instruction. Now go forth and sin beautifully.